Hello, everyone, and welcome to the RIA Edge podcast. I'm David Armstrong, the editor of wealthmanagement.com. This, as you know, is the podcast where I get a chance to speak to folks in the RIA industry who are studying growth, the growth trajectory of RIAs, how that happens. And today I'm thrilled to be speaking to John Orsini, a director at Marshberry. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
John, just before we begin, I know we've been working with you guys a lot on, and we've done quite a bit of research together, which is great. And that's what we're going to talk about today. But for the folks who don't know, you want to just give a 101 on Marshberry?
Yeah, sure. So Marshberry is a consulting and investment banking firm. We service wealth advisory, retirement planning, and insurance brokerage. In those roles, we do everything from strategic planning, valuation work. We assist with succession planning. We help firms to go to market. We help them grow organically and inorganically. And, you know, we're having just a lot of success, a lot of activity, and thrilled to be here today to kind of continue that conversation and share some of the things that we saw through the survey, and then also conversations that myself and my team are having out in the marketplace.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the focus on RIA growth is important to us. And I think the research that we've done together, when I look at it, and I look at it just in the totality, it's striking that, you know, as much as there is, you know, you've seen one RIA, you've seen one RIA, you've seen one path to growth, you've seen one path to growth. There's no path that suits every RIA. And the variety out there of ways that firms are growing is still stunning to me. When you look at the research and the totality that we've done, and when you talk to RIAs out there, what is your reflection on how they're trying to grow? You know, the mergers and acquisitions we talk about. We talk about organic growth. We talk about bringing services in-house. We talk about outsourcing services. There's all kinds of paths up the mountain. But do you have some general reflections on the industry overall and the need for growth, the impetus to grow these firms? Why is it important?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me begin by saying that, you know, as we look back and we reflect over the last, you know, coming out of that kind of 2008-09 timeframe, it's been pretty much a very strong run up during that time. And as firms continue to grow, I think we see oftentimes that they've kind of lost sight of the sources of that growth. So, you know, as they've kind of peeled back and look, and markets have become choppy over the last few years, and folks have begun to think about things a little bit more strategically, what they've done is looked at kind of that market adjusted asset growth. And we say that it means, you know, kind of backing out the market to see what are the sources of growth, where are they coming from, existing clients and new clients. And then as private equity has flooded into the market over the last several years, what we've seen is the competition has become fierce. And when we say that, there's just kind of basically unlimited services that can be provided at the higher end. And what that's done is increased the competition for the kind of rank and file firms in that 300 million to kind of 3 to 5 billion AUM space. And in saying that, what they've done is they started to look at and really listen to the voice of client, and then also study the marketplace. And, you know, what we found in the survey was pretty interesting in that there's pretty much a direct overlay between kind of the non-core services offered by firms, and then also the firms that aren't offering those, what they do plan to offer. So things like tax and estate planning, business planning, corporate retirement, succession services, et cetera. We see firms who are thinking long and hard about offering those services to really attract new clients and retain the clients that they have. What we found is, as we've had conversations, that there's a large part of this is really opportunistic. And when we say that, we think of examples of if I'm going to work on trust and estate planning, it's not necessarily something that's easily and readily done in-house, unless you happen to have somebody on your team who is, you know, maybe a Harvard educated attorney who has expertise there, or perhaps you have a relationship that you can leverage. Firms are really kind of struggling with the notion of, do we go internal for this? Do we look to acquire something, or do we look to partner? That's just one specific example, but it's really the thing that each of the firms is kind of facing there. And there's really not going to be a right answer for everyone. David, to your point, like there's different paths. Different marketplaces are going to have access to services readily that other markets may not. And firms need to think long and hard. Circling back to that kind of growth story, from 08 kind of forward, what we see here is, and I like to call it, fixed cost creep, meaning as you've grown, you continue to bring on new capabilities, technology, people to kind of do things. And the growing market kind of covers everything for you. So revenues continue to increase and you're feeling good and you continue to bring on new services to help the clients, to help your advisors. But what we found here is that as there's a little bit of fee compression that's happening, particularly on the higher end, firms are vulnerable. Margins are at risk if there's a significant pullback, and particularly if there's a pullback and it's prolonged. We're spending time with folks today working on strategic planning to help make decisions around what are the investments they should be making and how are they going to make those with an eye towards enterprise value.
Yeah, it's struck me. It wasn't that long ago that firms thought about growth in terms of just simply bringing more clients through the door, whether that was buying a firm to bring more clients in or whatever kind of marketing activity you had to do to bring more clients in. It didn't matter. Just growth was a factor of increasing the size of the book. You know, now it seems that that's kind of done and dusted, and firms that are serious about growth are taking the route of thinking about, okay, we need to offer more, right?
Yeah,
Estate planning, tax planning, whatever it might be.
that's right, David. And we always say whenever we have a conversation, the most important component of growth before you start anything is retention. So what are you doing to retain the clients that you have? What services do you need to keep them happy as they progress through the stages of their lives? Those folks that you brought in and they were in their 40s, 50s, as they migrate into their 60s and 70s, those needs change. So first and foremost, to continue to evolve to meet those needs, and whether you're handling it internally, whether you're partnering, or whether you're looking to acquire those capabilities, it's always front of mind. The other thing that we see from a retention perspective is the treatment of clients. So as folks age, what we're seeing, and you know, this is no surprise to anyone listening to this podcast, but the benefits of householding your clients. And for those that aren't familiar, when we say householding, it's kind of treating a relationship all the way down through the chain from parent to child to siblings. And what that means is what you're trying to do here is to retain in the event of a life event. Those life events can occur, and you know, we see it all the time where you have a really strong client and long-term relationship, but you haven't invested in the relationship with the child, and maybe even the grandchildren. And they have their own relationships. And at that event, you can lose some of those assets. So we see firms now offering this pricing, the services to that second and third gen in order to act as a mechanism to retain. Now, once you've had that and you've kind of stabilized and you're hanging on to, you know, 98-ish percent, you can begin to focus on growth. And you know, what we found, the thing we were most interested in this survey, David, and is to kind of see how it does it confirm or refute what we're seeing in the marketplace. And we think about businesses in a step function mindset or mechanism. So every firm, regardless of where they are, is at some point heading up the staircase. They may be at the rise where they need to make some investments, or they may need be at the point where they've made the investment and now they need to scale it significantly. What we're finding here is that in the past, folks were kind of just going and doing without necessarily being extremely thoughtful from a long-term perspective. And what we're finding now is that if folks are really spending the time necessary to make those decisions and saying, hey, does it, as we talked about first from a service perspective, partnering, acquiring, or building on your own, what we're finding is they're saying, from a partner perspective, does it make sense to partner even externally? Are there other advisors who we can come together with to merge in order to bring in some different capabilities? Are we able to potentially look at a strategic who can really fast track us to do the things that we do best? And there's just kind of a really unlimited number of options today. And folks are thinking about it just many different ways.
Yeah, and that it's I think that's what maybe for a lot of RIAs is daunting about it, right? The unlimited number of options. I mean, there are many ways down the path, but it's that buy or merge or outsource decision. Let's first of all, though, back up a little bit and think about what services firms are going to that they think, or you think, or in your experience have found talking to RIAs, get the most bang for the buck, so to speak. So, you do your basic blocking and tackling with financial planning and investment portfolio management, and then you decide to expand out to something else. I think through the survey we found, most advisors think that those services that are most beneficial to add are tax planning, estate planning, some sort of risk mitigation, insurance kind of services. You want to just reflect a little bit on, what you see out there when firms are looking to add additional services, which ones they're going to, which seem to make the most sense?
Yeah, for sure. So I think the one that always kind of jumps up, or actually I say the two that really jump up kind of front, and I'll they're not necessarily the same. I'll tackle the first, which would be tax planning. So people hear tax and you kind of think of there's two components. There's tax prep, which is labor intensive, low margin, and then there's tax planning, which is very much a necessary component of kind of the planning for any client. Tax is a major issue and can be a major source of drag on return. So firms are really working hard to figure that out. The issue here is that you don't necessarily have tax planning experts who are part of the firm. So this is where they're really spending the time to figure out who are the right relationships that they should have. Does it make sense to bring that capability in-house? And then also, is there tax prep that goes along with that? And then they're being very careful about bringing in that tax prep, because the thing you want to be careful of is just to say, hey, what's the overall profile of the firm? What is the service that we provide? And what's our culture? And tax prep's a different culture completely than that relationship of kind of the advisor. So firms are spending some time there. And then the other side of it is kind of I'll kind of pair it up and say, like, business planning. So offering services to business owners that are kind of outside of the norm of what you would think of from a traditional advisor perspective. And some of those can be, offering retirement or corporate retirement planning to offer 401k, act as that fiduciary there. Not necessarily something you're going to get wealthy on, but it really helps to bring on and retain that client. And then also it provides another channel of growth because you have participants whom you can kind of market to. And finally, the last piece here is just around digital advice. And I think about digital advice a couple of ways. At scale, digital advice looks like digital advice, where you're going to the web and you're finding solutions and things are happening in kind of an automated fashion. We think more about digital advice from a client attraction standpoint, or even retention on from a younger client base. So we think about that more like marketing. So how is it that you're interfacing with the client? Do you have an app? What are you doing on the web to go out there and kind of attract and grow? And what are those capabilities that kind of make sense for that younger generation investor who is not necessarily looking for the in-person meeting, but they want to have things at their fingertips? And how are they able to do things that not necessarily to make investment decisions? I think that there's still a ton of value, particularly in that, $300 million to $5 billion space, where the differentiation that's happening there is on the personal touch. I think that's we at Marshberry think that's still going to be a driver going forward, but the digital component of that is really becoming a necessary investment that firms have to make.
That's interesting because that goes back to your point of householding, right? Keeping the clients engaged, the kids of the clients engaged, keeping that money in-house or keeping it close. And that's really serving the client, right? I mean, that's what, clients might not articulate that, but bringing that to them is something I think that soothes them in a way, right? Helps them. And it strikes me that a lot of RIAs kind of stumble into some of these growth paths, right? You have a high net worth client who started a business and they have a bunch of employees and they need some help with their retirement plan for their employees. So suddenly you're a retirement plan advisor. Talk to me a little bit about how that kind of stumbling forward in growth versus deliberate making intentional growth, the differences there and what maybe the perils of the first path are.
David, I'm glad you said this. It reminds me of conversations that my team and I have been having recently with firms, and it kind of begins like this. There's an advisor, they have a vision. They say that, hey, this is what I would like to do. This is the client that I would typical client that I would like to serve. These are the services that I would like to provide. They kind of have their investment thesis. This is how we're going to serve clients from an investment perspective. This will be our service model. And then they go out and they grow and they take the growth that they can get because they have to keep the lights on and they have to pay the bills. So what happens there is that you kind of get your head up after a certain point in time and you say, hey, we've achieved some scale. We're a 400 8 million AUM firm. We're providing services X, Y, and Z. We have a couple of other advisors. We have some CSAs. You know, we're looking good. We're poised for that next level of growth. And then the question becomes is, okay, you've been successful to this point, but the path from 400 or 500 million is going to be significantly different on the pathway to a billion and a billion plus. So you have to, we find, and we spend time with firms right now helping them to kind of segment their clients and think about how they're going to service each client. Not everyone should be serviced the same, and not everybody wants to be serviced the same. And one of the things that we found in working with a firm down in, we'll call it just down in the southwest of the country, where what they found is that servicing clients in person meetings that they're kind of 50 plus, they really enjoy it. There's, you know, quarterly meetings, semi-annuals, annuals, what have you. With the younger gen, what they found is that events are something that they're a little bit more interested in. They want to say hi to their advisor. They want to have a relationship with them. They want to be able to refer business is the thing that's interesting. And we see firms that are kind of creating spaces within their offices or looking for new spaces where they can have events, not large, intimate, but provide opportunities on a monthly basis for clients to come in and to bring a friend. And it's become a great source of growth and something that I just think is really interesting. And you can see the shifting dynamic there of, you know, we can't just sit back and wait for referrals. We have to be a little bit more active out there. We have to make some investments. We have to be more than just the, hey, here's the days of these are the stocks that we're picking, or hey, this is how your funds are performing. Those days, it's still an important piece, but the relationship is more of it. And I always like to think from a, whenever you find a great contractor for homework to get projects done at your home, if that contractor does a great job, people love to make referrals because nobody can find a great contractor. And people feel the same way about advisors. It's a very intimate relationship. You're letting people behind the doors where no one else really sees besides you and your significant other, most likely. And it's a relationship that people are reluctant to step into. There are a large percentage of folks today who are self-provisioning, who have, you know, numerous 401ks, and they haven't sought advice before, but when they hear their friend and then they have a chance to meet with someone and trust can be established over a period of time, it's been a real nice source of growth for that kind of high potential professional or young professionals rather in their kind of late 30s, early 40s.
We invite you to join us on May 13th through 16th in Hollywood, Florida, for RIA Edge, part of the Wealth Management Edge event, with an agenda designed to help accelerate the growth of your RIA firm with the latest C-suite strategies. You'll walk away with frameworks and approaches for M&A, organic growth, and talent development. Use promo code PODCAST20 to save 20% on your registration. Visit wealthmanagementedge-event.com for more information.
Agreed. I think there's a sense, though, that for advisors on this growth trajectory who really want to go from that $300, $500 million level up to say yes to everything, right? The servicing your client is saying, absolutely, I can take care of that for you. And maybe not always you can, right? That, you know, that there's maybe value in saying no sometimes, to saying, no, we don't offer a particular service. You're better off going somewhere else. And I'm wondering from your perspective where that changes, right? You know, you grow, as you say, from that first, you know, 0 to 500 million is absolutely, we can do everything for you. Come on, one all, we'll do it, to a point where you start to say, no, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it in a very intentional manner versus just accommodating.
Yeah, so I think that's where the client segmentation comes in and where it's most important. So when we say client segmentation, we say, hey, it's not necessarily on just AUM and revenue generated. There's other factors involved, like, hey, what's the potential of this client or what's the relationship this client has with others? And it requires sometimes some difficult conversations to say, hey, first and foremost, we're a fiduciary. These services, they cost money and it doesn't make a ton of sense for you to have to pay for this service today. It's not a component of the pricing model that we have. So folks have to have those difficult conversations and sometimes they have to lose some clients over it, which what we're finding is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, the old Pareto rule, 80%, the 80-20 rule, 80% of the work is driven by 20% of the clients. That's fine if the 20% are those highest revenue contributors. But when you find that they're not, then you have to take that long, hard look and assess, is this a relationship that's valuable for us going forward? And sometimes you just have to part ways.
Yeah. And to your point earlier, one of the things that came out of the research that we did together that really struck me was the threats. And as advisors say, what is threatening to our trajectory if we do not offer it? And turns out it's not tax and estate planning, or it's not insurance and risk management. It is, to your point earlier, technology. You know, if we do not have the technology game front and center, that's going to be the biggest impediment to our growth.
Yeah, that's correct. So that's where kind of looking to that to the third party partnership model is the one that's really particularly on the size firms that we're focused on. We're finding those third party partners is what makes the most sense because, quite frankly, the investment that's required can be, you know, it can be debilitating. And then not just the investment, the do you have the professionalism in-house, the acumen, even the want and desire to do things. So finding those third parties who can align well with what you're looking for based on your client profile and based on your service model is something that's incredibly important.
I know Marshberry's done a lot of work in the insurance space and other divisions, not your division, but and I'm wondering if you notice any parallels to what's happening in the wealth management space to what has happened in the tax space and insurance space in terms of consolidation. You know, is there going to be a role continuing for the standalone RIA, the independent advisor down the block, hanging out their own shingle, or are we destined to a world where only the big aggregators or the large consolidators of financial services will win this game for the client?
So fantastic question. So the benefit here at Marshberry, so we've been around for 40 plus years at this point, and as you noted, our heritage is it's certainly an insurance brokerage for sure. And what we noticed dating back, let's just call it 2010, we start to see this kind of industry convergence. And when we say that, we say insurance brokerage kind of begets employee benefits begets retirement, corporate retirement planning. And corporate retirement planning, a natural extension there is wealth advisory. We noticed the movement of private equity into that space and dating back, and we think that the wealth is probably lagging 5 to 7 years behind. So we've seen recently just continued investments, M&A activity off to a record start this year. Our quarterly pieces will be out by the time this podcast goes, and we're showing the highest 1Q on record and the second highest quarterly transaction rate thus far. And the first couple of weeks here in April have also been just white hot. We found 15 transactions in just the first week or so. So there is a ton of activity here coming through. And what we're finding is that in insurance, it's been a self-perpetuating would be a better way to phrase it, meaning there's around 30 or so thousand brokers, and don't quote me on the number. And regardless of the amount of transactions that have taken place, there's still about the same amount of insurance brokerage firms, independents that are out there operating. We're seeing the same thing in wealth, where you know there's folks who are working at the large wirehouses continue to lift out, stand up their own practice, hang up their own shingle. There's acquisitions that are taking place for sure, and that's going to continue to grow. And we estimate that it'll probably be a record year this year from a transaction perspective, but we don't necessarily think that it means that you can't exist on an independent basis. We believe very strongly, and we see it in the market, that there are providers who are out there delivering services for folks so they can remain independent. And we believe that there will be a place going forward for the smaller shop. The question becomes, though, is that how do you bridge the chasm? And the folks here on this podcast are not aware, but I led M&A for Nationwide Investment Management 2013 through 2020. And in that role, we acquired mutual funds. And what I saw through that was kind of this bifurcation of the market called bimodal of firms operating up to a certain range and then a very long path in between and then another spike. And I'll just use arbitrary numbers and say up to 10 billion and then a large space and then over 100 billion in AUM. And we see the same thing here happening in wealth, which is you can service your client and very hands-on and really deliver that quality service, and you can leverage third parties. But in order to kind of grow and continue through, we think that there's going to be a gap there, in that there's going to be the supercharged powerhouses that have just capital behind it to build the services and the platform that they need. And it's going to become increasingly difficult for a firm to do that on their own, to get from 1 billion to 10, 10 to 50, without seeking private equity backing or someone else taking a minority.
Yeah, and that's interesting you say, because I think 2 years ago, year and a half ago, no one would have anticipated that the rate of M&A in this space would be at the pace that it is right now, with interest rates rising and the market wobbly, and but it continues, and it's amazing to me. It speaks to, I think, a lot of the money that's coming into the space, but also this notion of a need for additional services, and the feeling that you can't exist on your own. Now, you're saying you can exist on your own, and there certainly is a lot of ability to outsource to service providers to bring in those additional services, whether it be tax planning, estate planning, risk mitigation, insurance, whatever. Do you have some thoughts on the firms that you talk to who are making that decision whether to outsource additional services versus sell to or merge with or partner with a larger organization? At what are some of the drivers that would determine that decision? You know what I mean? What are they grappling with to as they weigh those options?
This typically, we're speaking purely about, not purely, but we're speaking primarily about growth here. And this growth conversation does not operate in a vacuum. And it's typically something that they're also, while trying to grapple with this, they're also dealing with succession. And when we say succession planning, we mean that kind of generation one founder to generation two, and even generation three in some cases. And when handling that, you have a couple of issues. So the generation two, always ready, willing, not necessarily able to take on the responsibility. And we say able, I'm speaking from a capital perspective. So firms that are attempting to grow and they're looking at the investments that they need to make are oftentimes wrestling with the, how do we get equity into the hands of Gen 2 and at what cost? So we see typically kind of a 40 to 50% internal discount rate, that from a valuation perspective and for internal transition. And oftentimes, as we're going through our strategic planning process, this Gen 1 begins to kind of think, okay, so we're going to make these investments. I'm going to have margin compression for some period of time, most likely. We have to believe that we're going to be able to grow at some other rate. Multiples currently exist today at this space. I have a 5 to 10 year horizon in front of me, and if I'm going to do something, what's the likelihood that I'm going to be successful in the market today? And then how is that going to change in the future? And then also, what's the value of my firm going to be in the future? And would I be better served, instead of partnering with somebody, and we say partner, we mean acquiring some services, entering into some contracts, what would it be more likely or better for me to just go ahead and sell this firm to a strategic, take on some equity there, take some risk off the table, put equity in the hands of my G2, provide better career pathing, provide those capabilities and services for my clients, and then give me kind of a runway off into the sunset? When we have the conversation with firms, and when they see Marshberry at their door, the first thing that most will say is that, hey, I'm not interested in selling. I don't want to retire. And our answer is that, well, congratulations. If you sell, you're not really going to be able to retire if you want to maximize value. M&A today is not about firms just acquiring assets and revenue. They're trying to acquire talent and great, strong footholds and great marketplaces for firms that have been around for a while. And if you're going to do that, you want to maximize value, you're going to need to stay around for at least 3 years. 5 to 7 is preferable. So it's another element and component that is kind of entered into the equation on that decision of, do I build, do I buy, or do I partner? That partner may not mean necessarily just entering into a contract with a provider, but actually joining a larger third party.
Yeah, and the interesting to me that it used to be, it was very much a kind of a family business in some ways, right? The how many advisory firms do we know where the children take over for the parents? It happens all the time. That seems to be happening less, as you say, the second generation of advisors, even if they're just junior advisors who are brought in, often can't afford the equity buy-in to a firm because of the valuations are so high these days. How do you advise firms grappling with that?
Yeah, so it's certainly interesting before, and the conversation has become much more difficult, if I'm going to be frank. The multiples today are certainly a lot higher than they were 5 years ago. And 5 years ago, the internal perpetuation discussion was a lot easier because the valuations weren't as high, the gap was smaller, and there was some ability there. But with valuations continuing to remain very strong, multiples high, it's become difficult for folks to do so. And I've had some instances recently where, where children have said, "I would like to acquire, I'd like to have my father or parents or whomever bring the business down to me, but quite frankly, they deserve the ability to go out there and monetize today. I can take equity in a larger entity, and they can do things for me that I'm not necessarily interested in doing today." And one of the things that, David, that we think about and we hear all the time here is that folks who start businesses have a different level of risk tolerance than folks who come to work for your firm. So you can be a great business mind, you can grow, you can be great with clients, but that risk appetite is not there as it is for someone who is a true entrepreneur who has said, "I am going to do this. We're going to eat top ramen for a few years here. We're going to drive around in a our 10-year-old Honda Accord. We're going to keep the vacations to a minimum as we grow this thing." These folks who have come over and who've been afforded a nice lifestyle and are making really good income today don't necessarily have the wealth or the tolerance to go forward and make that investment. So it really is a conundrum. It's most firms are handling it in different ways, but we see more and more who are really thinking long and hard about about taking their firm to market, particularly in the face of, if we just pull back and we say, on average, the average advisor is in their early 60s, the average business owner is in their mid to late 50s, and you couple that with what valuations are today, the uncertainty of the future, and the need for acquirers to have those business leaders in those seats for some time post-transaction to maximize value. We have a lot of firms that are thinking long and hard about it today, and many who are making the decision to go to market in a formal way.
Yeah, and that bifurcation of the, it's not a pejorative, but to say lifestyle practice, and those firms love their clients, take great care of their clients, no doubt, but without the considerations for the future trajectory of the business, and can't just turn on a dime and make the decision that my book's worth something, I can sell it, probably not, right? I mean that those days are probably done, right? Firms that aren't prepped to go to market in terms of a growing book of business, a certain clientele, a particular service that you bring, a particular expertise that you bring, and like you say, the ability to stick around for a while, those are requirements to go to market. You just don't sell a book on the on in the marketplace these days, right?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly to the large acquirers. There certainly is plenty of activity though within that, we'd say the 2 to 5 billion AUM space where firms are certainly acquisitive. But as you think about things, as you go from kind of a book of business to kind of a practice to a business to a platform, the valuation multiples that you command are just going to, they're going to be a lot lower on the lower end, unless you have a really great niche client that you're serving, a demographic, a profile that bodes quite well, that aligns with what firms are looking for. You think younger, if your book is younger, professional, you're householding, you have a good line of sight into future growth. The folks are business owners who have the opportunity to sell externally going forward. If you don't have that profile, it's going to be increasingly difficult to fetch a high multiple on the lower end for sure.
So we're coming up to the end of our time here, but I have one more quick question for you. You hypothetically, Marshberry knocks on the door of a RIA and they have the desire to do everything you say. Prep 5 years beforehand, 10 years beforehand, want to do what they need to do to make sure that that monetization event in 5, 10 years is as high as it can be, as successful as it can be. What is the top piece of advice you give them at this stage to make sure that that happens? What is the one thing they can do to make sure that they are on the right trajectory for that success?
Be intentional. And we say be intentional, we say get your leaders together, your equity holders, whatever that is, each firm will be different. Develop a business plan and then execute to that plan and hold yourself accountable, meaning regular check-ins. Be adaptive. So just because you say you're going to do something by some point in time, or these are the investments that we want to make sequentially, continue to evaluate and assess and do everything with an eye towards enterprise value. And when we say that, think about the investments that you're making today and say, are these investments going to be worthwhile down the road? I like to use some analogies. I'm 50 years old. I began college with an electric typewriter, which begat a word processor and then a computer. Had I invested heavily in typewriter repair at that time, probably wouldn't have been a great place to be. If I had had some foresight and thought about personal computers and software and the things that were moving there, that would have been a great investment to make. Business owners need to be thinking the same thing today. What's going to be that path forward? We think that, kind of the holy grail here is if you can work with business owners, if you can provide them the suite of services that they need, and you can provide, I'd say value add and things that are outside of the scope of the norm, and you can deepen those relationships and they can provide referrals and you can have access to the participants in their 401k plan. You have a strong path forward, but above all, be intentional, iterate, and hold yourself accountable.
That's fantastic. Many, many paths up the mountain, but just don't stumble up the mountain, right?
That's it. Absolutely.
Well, this has been great. John Orsini, director at Marshberry, thanks very much for the conversation. I've learned a lot, and folks who are interested in the research can find it on our website, and I think I can go to marshberry.com and find additional resources. It's a fantastic conversation. Thanks very much.
Dave, it's my pleasure. Take care.
And thank you for listening. This has been the RA Edge podcast.